You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Tonight, we welcome Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha, a pediatrician turned detective, and the author of the book What the Eyes Don't See, a story of crisis, resistance, and hope in an American city. That city, of course, is Flint, Michigan, where a government poisoned its own citizens and then lied about it. This beautifully written and passionate book, a memoir as much as it is a detective story, is not only a story about a water crisis, it's a story about how each of us, no matter who we are or where we are or how we ended up in this country, has the power to fix things. And I think it's a real antidote to these times. I felt that while reading it, and I think you'll feel that too when you hear Dr. Mona tonight. In her conversation tonight with LA Times reporter Jeff Moen, we'll learn more about how the crisis in Flint developed, how Dr. Mona, as she likes to be called, took action, and how the people of Flint today are building resilience through evidence-based interventions. Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha is Detroit-raised. She's a first-generation Iraqi-American. She was raised by dissident scientists with family roots in social justice that buoyed her through the struggle to address what she herself calls, quote, the most important and emblematic environmental and public health disaster of this young century. She's the director of the pediatrics residency at the Hurley Medical Center in Flint, Michigan, and an assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. She's been twice called upon to testify before the U.S. Congress, and she was awarded the Freedom of Expression Courage Award from PEN America. Dr. Mona reminds us that it is the job of a pediatrician not just to treat children's bodies, but to fiercely protect their potential. And I think that's a great guideline for the present moment for all of us. Our interlocutor tonight, we're very fortunate to have Jeff Moen, who joined the Los Angeles Times in 2001 from Newsday. He was then Latin American bureau chief in Mexico City. He covered the Afghanistan and Iraq wars and was part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of the California wildfires in 2003. He served as editor of the Metro and Foreign Desks before returning to report on science in 2013, and he now covers agriculture and food for the LA Times. He recently covered the romaine lettuce E. coli contamination story, which affects all of us, so he has a wide knowledge, and we're very thrilled that he can interview Dr. Mona tonight. Please welcome our two distinguished guests to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming. Is this an indication of how many people don't have air conditioning at home? Or is it genuine interest in the environment? Good, good, yeah. Good. I'm glad.
Thank you.
Good. Well, it's a pleasure to be invited to this. I know it sounds like I have a rather odd resume to be doing this, but I was once environment editor, and I've always tried to hew very close to environmental issues.
And he read the book, so that's what.
And I read the book. I read it in its uncorrected proof. And has everyone here read it? I'm sure everyone's read it, right? Thank you for your honesty. I ran across a passage that I thought was a good way to introduce what I think it is that you accomplish in this book. And it's Edward Wilson from his Letters to a Young Scientist. And he says that he describes what it is to be an innovator in science. The successful innovator is favored by a fortunate combination of talent and circumstance and is socially conditioned by family, friends, teachers, and mentors, and by stories of great scientists and their discoveries. And it struck me that you hit that nail on the head in this book. I mean, this is a book that is, you could not characterize this strictly as a memoir. You could not characterize this strictly as a book about epidemiology. or science or medicine. It's kind of all of those things at once. You manage to weave those threads really, really deftly through this. So I thought that would be a good way to set this, have people understand this book. If you want to, would you like to read a passage from it, maybe?
Sure, I will read a passage. And it is great to see everybody here. Thank you for having me in LA, the beautiful city. It's humbling to be in this gorgeous library, in this gorgeous space, and part of this series. So thank you all, and thank you for caring. Thank you for being interested in this story. So you're right. This book is a mix of a lot of different things. So if you're expecting a book just on the Flint water crisis, this is not that book. This is so much, I think, more than that. It incorporates a lot about me, because you can't really understand my role in this crisis without learning who I am and where I came from and where I got my values and my drive to do this work and to be in Flint and to ultimately have my eyes open to be part of exposing this crisis. But it's also about history, it's about science, it's about medicine, it's about geography and economics and race and democracy. So there's a lot of intersecting issues in this story. Ultimately, it's also an immigrant story, and we'll get to that probably a little later. So there's a mix of a lot of different things in here, and I hope you enjoy. So I'll read a passage that is part of a part of the prologue, and you heard a little bit of it earlier, but I will read a little bit of a longer passage, which kind of summarizes what this book is about and what the story is about. This is the story of the most important and emblematic environmental and public health disaster of this young century. More bluntly, it is the story of a government poisoning its own citizens and then lying about it. It is a story about what happens when the very people responsible for keeping us safe care more about money and power than they care about us or our children. The crisis manifested itself in water and in the bodies of the most vulnerable among us, children who drank that water and ate meals cooked with that water, and babies who guzzled bottles of formula mixed with that water. The government tried hard to convince parents that the water was fine, safe, when it wasn't. But this is also a story about the deeper crises we are facing right now in our country. A breakdown in democracy, the disintegration of critical infrastructure due to inequality and austerity, environmental injustice that disproportionately affects the poor and the black, the abandonment of civic responsibility and our deep obligations as human beings to care and provide for one another. Those are all demoralizing realities to face, but there is another side of Flint, because it is also a story of how we fought back and how each of us, no matter who we are, a parent, an activist, a school teacher, a pediatrician, has within us a piece of the answer. We each have the power to fix things. So this is a story of that crisis. It is a story of activism and resistance, which is a story that we need right now. And it is a story of hope.
Okay, we're done.
Let's sign books, okay.
So for the folks who haven't gotten the chance to read it,
I mean, it's already been out 2 weeks.
I realize it's like probably only five or six of you who haven't read it. Let's talk a little bit about what the title means.
Yeah, so
because I find it an interesting axiom. That
yeah,
it's based on.
There's like, where is the word Flint in this title? What are you talking about? What does this title mean? So the title is What the Eyes Don't See, and it's the very literal. So I have a glass of water, and my water is clear. We do not see lead in water. It is invisible, it is odorless, it is tasteless. We don't see it. We also do not see the consequences of lead exposure. So lead is known in pediatrics and public health as a silent pediatric epidemic. I wish children who were exposed to lead got like bright glow-in-the-dark rashes. And they're like, oh, we could treat it. They're exposed. But we don't see anything. I love to trick my medical students that come in to the clinic. I'm like, how does a kid with lead poisoning present? They'd be like, oh, he stomach pain and headaches and problems in school. It's like, no, it is silent. And we may see those symptoms, consequences really, years and maybe decades later. And when we do see them, it can be multifactorial and we can't even prove causation. So lead we do not see. But ultimately, this title is way more than a story and way more than Flint, because it is about people and places and problems in Flint and beyond that we choose not to see. The injustices all around us that we choose to just cover our eyes and not see. And it is about the necessity and the ability and our responsibility for all of us to open our eyes. And not only to be awake and alert and to see these things, but to act on them.
But you had a mentor who would say this, the full saying would remind you.
Yeah, so I first heard this saying, which is a D.H. Lawrence distillation, from one of my professors in residency, in pediatric residency. And he was one of those old school pediatricians who would drill you when you were on rounds, seeing patients in the intensive care unit. And if you couldn't figure out a diagnosis, or if you didn't understand the underlying pathophysiology of anything, he'd always say, "The eyes do not see what the mind does not know," saying, "You have not read enough and you do not know enough. So go back home and keep reading, because if you do not know that something exists, you will not be able to diagnose it and treat something." And this speaks to kind of my blindness in this crisis. Before my friend told me that of the possibility of lead in the water, I never even knew there was lead in plumbing before that. I didn't even know there was lead in plumbing. And I have taken care of dozens, if not hundreds, of children with elevated lead levels. And I've taken long histories and taken physicals and asked about all their multiple exposures. And I never even knew that lead was in water before this. So there's a lot of things that we just don't see because we don't know.
And that's I think that's something that's in common with journalism as well, is that we often don't see things like this. I think in journalism, at least nationally, we were very late to the Flint story. It was covered locally very well, as you point out in the book, but it was very late to be picked up by major national newspapers, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times,
right,
et cetera. I think that's the other issue there is that it's sort of like in epidemiology too. You may not see these things unless you really run the numbers and do the math. In some sense, we're doing the first draft of history. You're doing the first draft of science. I wanted to go a little bit more into that sort of failure of imagination, the notion that we, as a country, are starting to have blind spots toward whole sections of our culture, like Flint. This, to me, appears to be a fundamental threat to democracy, which I think underlies this book, which is really what this book is about assessing the state of our democracy.
Yeah, it's about who we are and who we want to be. Are we okay with some children getting clean water and some kids not getting clean water? Are we okay with populations who no longer have a democratic democracy? The story of Flint is a story of democracy taken away from the people. We were under emergency management. Are we okay with that? In Michigan, at one point, 50% of our African Americans were under emergency management compared to 2% of whites. Are we okay with that? Are we okay with environmental injustices in Flint and elsewhere? Are we okay with the disrespect for science? So this is about so many bigger issues of where we are right now in this nation that we should not be okay with.
And talk a little bit now. You on a personal level, your eyes were opened at one point. A friend of yours whispered to you famously at a barbecue that, hey, something's wrong with the water here. But talk a bit about also the eye-opening that happened on a broader sense on this. The struggle you had to direct people's attention to this, and the resistance particularly that you had, because I think that's pretty significant that there was a lot of resistance to what you found.
Yeah, so this book is a page turner, and you'll get at all of the obstacles that went into trying to find out what was going on. And it all started very much by serendipity. So I was at home, last minute barbecue with high school girlfriends who happened to be in town, drinking a glass of wine. So the moral of the story is go home, hang out with friends, have wine. What's that saying? Like, no good stories happen after salad or something. Just connecting with friends. And my high school girlfriend happens to be a water expert. I didn't really know. She happened to work at the EPA about a decade ago when in Washington, D.C., when Washington, D.C. had a very similar lead and water crisis. And she had seen a leaked memo from one of her former EPA colleagues about Flint. And so she cornered me with glasses of wine in our hand. Our children were playing and screaming, and the food had just come off the barbecue. And she's like, Mona, and her eyes were absolutely boring into my eyes, and her tone had changed. She's like, what are you hearing about Flint water? I'm like, it's okay. The state says everything's okay. I just saw patients in clinic this week. The mom was worried, and she wanted to know if it was okay to mix her baby's formula with this water. And I told her it was okay, because how could our tap water not be okay? Okay, this is America. This is the 21st century. This is Michigan. Do any Michiganders out there? Oh my God, look at the Michiganders. Okay, so how do we say where we're from, all the Michigan people? Okay, we are, Lansing maybe, or Midland. Where are you from?
Yeah.
Flint, oh my God, Flint's, rock on, Flintstones. Okay, Flint, look at all these Flint people. What about you? More Flint? Saginaw, so we are
no
the Mitten State.
No UP people here?
Well, we forget about the UP. The UP is like up here.
That's so, Canada.
But the
that's
UP,
Canada, right?
the UP is in the book, because I actually lived in UP for a little bit in Michigan Tech in Houghton, Michigan.
Upper Peninsula. We were speaking Michigan.
So, yeah.
I'll translate for you.
The Upper Peninsula, UP, also known as Upers. So Michigan is the Mitten State. So why are we the Mitten State? What are we surrounded by? The Great Lakes. We are surrounded by the largest source of fresh water in the world. And I was just at a talk with our Congressman Kildee. He's like, Mona, you're wrong. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, it's actually the largest source of fresh water in the universe. He's like, do you guys know of planets that have water? I don't know, maybe, who knows? So the largest source of fresh water in the universe, and here's Flint. Literally in the middle of the
if
largest source.
We have
source.
JPL people here. They might contest that. I don't know.
What's JPL? Okay.
NASA. NASA up in Pasadena. They might all argue. Right. I mean, maybe they found some ice crystals on Mars.
Probably. There's a lot that our eyes don't see. There's a lot that we don't know. So how can this be? Like, how can like, I? She was like, of course I was reassuring my patients that the water is okay, because this is America. We're in the middle of the Great Lakes. There's rules and there's regulations and there's laws. But there's people who wake up every day and make sure that our water is okay. And I imagine them in my head wearing lab coats with test tubes, making sure that our water is okay. How could our water not be okay? And I'm not naive. I mean, like, to government, like, you know, of course our water's okay. And she, at this barbecue at my house, says, well, the water's not being treated with something called corrosion control. And I still stared blankly at her, like, what the heck is corrosion control?
Googling it.
Yeah.
Right. How do you spell corrosion? Is it two R's?
And she's like, without corrosion control, without this necessary mandated ingredient, the metals that are in your pipes are going to come out and go into the water. And I'm like, okay. And she's like, there's going to be lead in your water. And that was the very, very first time I heard the word lead. And when a pediatrician or anybody in public health hears the word lead, we freak out. We know what lead does. It is a potent, irreversible neurotoxin. We've known about lead's evil for decades, if not centuries. And we also, most damning, it's an environmental injustice. We know that it is a form of environmental racism. We know that it is our country's most vulnerable children. And our Flint kids already had higher lead levels. But it's our kids in Flint and Detroit and Chicago and Baltimore and Philly, some of our country's most vulnerable children already are exposed to lead. And we now know that there is no safe level. So when I heard about the possibility of lead in the water, that changed my life. And that ended any eating or sleeping. And it began this really quest to find out if that lead in the water was getting into our children.
And tell us a little bit about what that was like, because I think it's helpful. People talk frequently about citizen science, and I think this is a testament to citizen science, but it is also a testament to good old-fashioned science, trained science. And I'm not sure that we, as human beings, are used to thinking scientifically, even though we think we do. We don't often think statistically. You know, if I ask you if the divorce rate is higher in Hollywood than elsewhere, everyone will say, of course it is, because they'll think of all the divorce cases that they've heard, but they don't think of the base rate of divorce mm-hmm. throughout the society. And there's many examples of that. So I think we often will look at something like, oh, there's elevated amounts of lead, that proves the issue. Mm-hmm. You know, I found X amount of elevated lead in glasses of water, so someone needs to do something. It's not that way. As the book shows, there was a great deal of very tough, rigorous science to do that was attacked.
Right.
So talk about how...
Sure. And to take it a step back, so I did the science that looked at children's blood lead levels, but it never, ever should have gotten to the point of me needing to do that science, of me needing to prove that there was more lead in our children's blood. This crisis should have stopped when that first mom raised a jug of brown water and said, something's wrong with my water. When she said, there's something wrong with my children, and the people of Flint were dismissed. Many amazing moms and activists for 18 months, for a year and a half, were raising their voices. Journalists were doing heroic investigative reporting and saying there was something wrong. Within a few months after switching to this untreated water, the Flint River, that wasn't treated properly, General Motors, which was born in Flint, stopped using this water because it was corroding engine parts. Think about that. This water was corroding our engine parts. That should have ended this crisis. Hard stop, like fire alarm bells, like that should have stopped. That's science. That is science.
The public health response is to err on the side of caution.
To
maybe stop drinking.
Right.
But it didn't happen.
There's a fundamental concept in public health called the precautionary principle, which you err on the side of caution. And in public health, lead is something that you're supposed to do something called primary prevention with. You're never supposed to expose a population to it. So that was science. Like corroding engine parts, that's science, right? So that should have been respected. And then when a water scientist, Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech, one of the world's leading experts in lead and water and corrosion control, he found out from a mom that the state wasn't doing anything about this. When he found out, he literally packed his minivan overnight with graduate students and supplies, and he drove from Blacksburg, Virginia, which is in the middle of nowhere, to Flint overnight to pair up with the people of Flint to use something called citizen science to provide more objective science on the water. And he transparently shared that science, that there was lead in the water throughout the city in the thousands and hundreds of parts per billion. So to get a little wonky, so how much lead is supposed to be in our water? Trick question. Zero. Okay.
So a lot of goose eggs
zero.
Out there.
So the EPA's maximum contaminant goal for lead in water is zero. However, they set an action level for a water system. So a system has to comply with an action level of 15 parts per billion. That's for the system. It is not based on health at all. It isn't based on the feasibility of that water utility. The FDA regulates lead in water in water bottles. Anybody, you get extra credit. Anybody know what that action level is? 5. So the action level for lead in water bottles is 5. We had lead in water samples in Flint in the hundreds and thousands of parts per billion. We had a home that measured 22,000 parts per billion lead in water. My lowest day in this crisis was when a home adjacent to the hospital for neglected and abandoned children had a lead level of 5,000 parts per billion. I mean, it was like the world was conspiring against these children who had every obstacle. So that science was there. Lead was in the water. That should have ended this crisis. We do not need to be using children as detectors, as canaries of environmental exposure, which is very much what we do in public health with lead. If we detect it in the environment, full stop. But everybody who had raised concerns along the way, from the moms and the activists and the pastors and the journalists and the water experts, were dismissed, were denied, were discredited. This renowned MacArthur genius scientist, Mark Edwards, was actually called a magician by the state, that he was pulling rabbits out of hats, as in wherever he goes, he was just kind of pulling elevated lead levels. So I knew I needed to have that data. I needed to see what was happening to children's lead levels. And kind of related to the title, doctors are very myopic. We only see the children in front of us. We only see the cases in front of us. So that's why we need to take a step back. And that's why blood lead levels are part of surveillance programs. Public health departments at the county and state level track blood lead levels so they can see what's happening to populations and look at trends over time. So I tried to get that big surveillance data from our county and our health department. Couldn't get it. They wouldn't give it to me. And then did the own research through our hospital records and looked at the lead levels of children that were done before the water switch and compared them to after the water switch. And it was those lead levels were done as part of routine screening because we screen high-risk children for lead exposure at the ages of 1 and 2. So that's when kids are at risk for household lead exposure. That's when they're walking and crawling and have hand-to-mouth activity. They're at risk for lead paint and lead soil and lead dust. Lead in water impacts a younger age group, a more developmentally vulnerable age group, and even babies. And the detection of lead in your blood is very short. It has a short half-life. Even though we showed an increase in the percentage of kids with elevated lead levels, it was a massive underestimation because many kids weren't being tested and they weren't being tested at the right ages.
And of course, that's the end of the story, right? As you presented the data, everybody responded perfectly as you would expect in a fully democratic society, right?
Yeah, because like when you're a doctor, you think people will listen and you're presenting science and facts and evidence and statistics. You think, you know, end of story. And I shouldn't have been surprised because, like I said, everybody in this story who raised their voice was attacked. So I was kind of prepared to be attacked, but nothing can prepare you from the attacks that an entire state unleashes on you. Almost every department of the state, the governor's office, the health department, the water quality department, attacked my science, attacked my credibility.
They said you were slicing and dicing.
Unfortunate researcher. And my favorite, which is also sexist, they said I was causing near hysteria.
Yeah, which the etymology, should the linguist do this or the scientist? hysterectomy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was from a time when they believed that a woman's womb could move around the body, and when the womb moved to the head, she was hysterical. So it is, if those of you who don't know that, you might want to work on getting that word out of your vocabulary. It's the N-word of feminism.
Yeah, which was a common way to attack women.
Right.
I talk a lot about public health history and lead history, and those same attacks were made in the 1920s against a brave woman scientist named Alice Hamilton, who went up against the lead and gas industry, and they also called her hysterical.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but you went through great lengths in this, and I know from reading scientific reports, you know, I look for things like this, a p-value on the statistics, et cetera. You had this wonderful Jenny who was doing your statistics for you. But you also did things like you control for seasonality because in different seasons, you might have different reasons. You made sure that you compared one season to another. You did quite a lot and did a rather subversive thing, I think, which we'll get to, tends to run in your family, as I understand. You pushed this to get through peer review and published.
But initially our research was a form of academic disobedience. So we presented this research at a press conference. And any kind of doctors or academics out there, that is not what you do with research.
At all.
That's an academic no-no. I recently received an award from MIT called the Disobedience Award. And that was hard to explain to my children.
And you'll see in this that Mona actually translates as badass. In this. I don't know if you've gotten to that part yet.
Yeah, but there was no other option. To go through that peer review process to get something published takes months and months. And our children did not have another day. And that's another lesson of this book, is that science sometimes can't wait. And science cannot live in ivory towers. And science cannot live in journals and that don't get read. Science needs to be of benefit to our communities and needs to work hand in hand with our communities.
Well, let's talk about your history of badassery, as I might, as I might call it. In the book, you mentioned that you were... rather polite and didn't use terms like that, but toward the end you were using a great deal of vernacular.
There's a little bit of profanity towards the end of the book.
But you do have a history. Your family has a history of both being a minority in a very difficult country, and being a minority here. You describe yourself as a brown woman in a white lab coat in a black city, in a very kind of white world, or whitewashed world. And I think that
with dark suits.
Of dark suits, of men. I find it interesting that oftentimes it's immigrants who can hold the mirror to us better than we can hold the mirror to
ourselves.
Immigrants
get the job done.
Exactly. We got immigrants out here. Yeah. Yeah. There were two illegal immigrants in my background, so I'm glad they decided to jump ship. But as Edward Wilson noted about innovators, you are socially conditioned, and the right opportunity comes at the right time and you react to it. Talk a little bit about your own upbringing and why where you come from matters in where this narrative eventually went.
Absolutely. So I wasn't supposed to be in this country. I was born in England, in Sheffield, England. My father was getting his PhD. He had a scholarship from Iraq, which is where my family is from. He finished his PhD in metallurgical engineering. So I always grew up with metals and the periodic table and science. My mom was a chemist. And he finished his PhD in the late 1970s. And the plan was to go back to Iraq. That's where all our family was. My first language was English. We were never supposed to be here. But in the late 70s was really the beginning of the reign of Saddam Hussein. You guys remember him, dictator Saddam Hussein? My parents were beginning to hear reports of friends gone missing, of the rise of fascism, of the stifling of voices. And my parents were scientists, they were leftists, they were progressives. They had two small children. I have a brother who's a year older than me that was born in Baghdad. And they knew they couldn't go back home. If my father was to go back home, he was slated to work at a nuclear plant. And he didn't want his science to go to support a Ba'athist regime. So we immigrated to the States, where it was really the beginning of the Iraqi diaspora. For the next 30 plus years, the more immigrants from Iraq, as it continued to kind of fall into ruins, would leave that country. We are Chaldean. Has anybody ever heard what Chaldean is? So, okay, some people. So we are Iraqi.
Someone from Michigan.
Okay. So we are...
Which part are you from?
Good job. We are Iraqi Christian, Iraqi old kind of Eastern Catholic. My parents grew up in Baghdad, but our roots are traced to generations of scribes who wrote Aramaic and preserved these scribes in monasteries for about 12 generations. And as a form of rebellion, really, against Roman Catholicism. And then a long kind of history of folks in my family who've always fought for justice. It's in this book, and I think it's one of my favorite stories. But in the 1930s, I had a great uncle named Nuri, who left Iraq to go to MIT, to study at MIT in Cambridge. He was so radicalized at Cambridge, it was during the Great Depression, that he lost his government scholarship, got kicked out of school, went back to Iraq, which he thought was very bleak at the time, and founded founded a document that called for Iraq's independence from British rule. It's like as if he like was inspired by the Declaration of Independence, like writers in Boston at the time. He also founded an organization called the Association Against Imperialism and Fascism. He then spent half of his life in jail or fleeing the government, found his way from Baghdad to Spain in the 1930s to fight in the Spanish Civil War. So there were two Iraqis who went from Baghdad to Spain, him and his best friend, who was an Iraqi Jew. And they traveled and fought in the International Brigade and part of the Lincoln Battalion with the Americans in the ultimate fight against fascist, this borderless cause. These were folks from all like different countries who came together, not for race, not for religion, not for country, but for an ideal of justice. So that is the milieu of my childhood. That is the values that were imparted in me. And when we came to the States and were raised in the States, my parents never shielded us from what was happening back home. My father was still part of the opposition movement, trying to share the badness of Saddam Hussein, who was a friend of the United States at that time. And I remember the first time he showed me. He showed me the first time I saw a dead baby. He showed me a picture of a baby who was poisoned in Halabja. So if you remember, Halabja was the largest chemical attack. It was in northern Iraq. Saddam Hussein poisoned an entire city and 5,000 people were murdered that day. And I saw this baby, this picture of this baby, this beautiful fat baby in a pink blanket who was being held by her father, both of them dead on the road. And my father showed this to me. He wanted me to know what people in power could do to vulnerable populations. And that scarred me for life, but that also gave me that heightened sense of injustice. So that was one of the many things that really forced me to pledge my career to service, to be in vulnerable populations, to fight for those, no matter where they be, who continue to suffer. So I think that immigrant background, that lens, I tried not to include part of it of this in the book, but that's me, and that's how I see the world, and that's the perspective, and you know, that's my vision, and that had to be included, because to not know that and to not include it, you don't understand who I am or why I do what I do. So I think it was with that lens that I did have this heightened sense where other people had their eyes closed. I had my eyes open because of that background.
Is that what made you become a pediatrician? And were you always an activist? How would you describe yourself prior to this great eye-opening as a pediatrician first and maybe hidden activist?
Yeah, so I don't know if there's any pediatricians in the audience, but pediatricians are advocates. It is in our job description to be advocates. I was trained to be an advocate. I, as a medical educator, train my pediatricians to be advocates. We are told to use our very credible voice to speak up for kids. Unfortunately, kids can't vote, but we'll try to change that. But it's our job to advocate for better gun control and, you know, immunizations and car seat safety and all these other things. Even before this crisis, I take my pediatricians in training to the state capitol, and we meet with legislators and advocate for children's, what children need. So it is this work, what I did, what I continue to do, is part of my professional obligation. I literally took an oath as a physician to protect children. But I dare you to think that shouldn't we all take that oath? Isn't this an oath that we are all need to take? Aren't we all intended to protect children, especially our most vulnerable children?
We'll
take that oath later. I'm going to break out my Hippocratic oath.
I would say unless they're crossing the border, apparently. But you, this is the policy that we have, and we've, you know, we own it. You suffered something of a trauma as a child. You start the book with that story. And that's important to this full story. You speak about adverse
childhood experiences.
Right, ACEs. Thank you. Adverse childhood experiences. You had one yourself. This informs it
very much. Tell us a little bit about how that kind of played into you understanding the broader context of what trauma really means when we're talking about children. Because people think trauma as a physical trauma or as a single acute event, but it's much different than that.
Yeah. So you can read the traumatic accident that happened. I'm not going to give that away, but I'll talk about childhood trauma. So I think the most important thing that we are learning in pediatrics and public health is the recognition of what early trauma, early adversity, early toxicity does to children. And this is how we've very much framed our crisis in Flint. It's not just a lead crisis. It is a trauma. It is a trauma of betrayal, of anger, of stress, of fear. It was not just lead. We had the largest outbreak of Legionnaire's disease. People died. There's actually homicide charges against folks. It is a trauma. But children all over are suffering from very similar traumas and adversities. It's traumas of poverty, trauma of violence, trauma of parent separation, the trauma of incarcerated parents, the trauma of lack of safe places to play. All of these things have additive and predictable impacts on children's life course trajectory. There's great, this amazing emerging science right now on what toxic stress does to children, what these early adversities do to children. It increases risk-taking behaviors. It leads to developmental disabilities. It leads to chronic diseases like asthma and diabetes and obesity and cardiovascular disease, and it actually impacts mortality. If you have six or more of these adverse childhood experiences, it actually drops your life expectancy 20 years. Our children in Flint, pre-water crisis, had a 15-year less life expectancy than children in a neighboring adjacent zip code. And this is not unique to Flint. There are wonderful studies all over this nation that show the zip code you are born in is the greatest predictor of where you will end up. And that is not right. And that needs to change. And that is this incredible role of toxic environments. And back in the day, these toxic environments used to be infections and poor sanitation and poor water. I talk a lot about 19th century London and cholera epidemics and the times of Charles Dickens when your mortality was dependent on what you did in your career. But it hasn't. I mean, we've made massive improvements, but it really hasn't changed that much, because ultimately it is the environment of where our children live. And if you broaden that to include that hopelessness and that violence and that racism and that discrimination and that poor water and that lack of opportunity, that all impacts children's actual minutes they live on this earth.
Well, we're going to probably transition to question and answers, but I had one more thing. And since I'm looking around and everybody looks rather long in the face and depressed about this.
Oh, that's a good idea. Let's go to the awesomeness.
I'm going to try to bring it up a little bit. Okay, so look, we're in the doctor's office. This is America here. What is your prescription?
Yeah.
What do you diagnose as the problem? What's your prescription? What's the part of this story that's about hope?
Absolutely. So this book is very much about the tragic and terrible lessons of what happened in Flint. But I wrote this book because it's also this incredible story of activism, of resistance, of the power of team. This is not about me. This is about a group of folks who are so different. Moms and activists and journalists and water scientists who don't look alike, who aren't of the same profession, who don't vote alike, who came together for a common purpose. Before this crisis, like I lived in my bubble of pediatrics and my professional bubble, and so often we become hyper-specialized in our work. And I thought that pediatricians had a monopoly on caring for children. Like, who else cares about kids more than pediatricians? And I found out that a water expert cared about kids more than I did. And I found out that journalists did. And I found out that so many others. So the part of the lessons of this book is that sometimes we think we are alone in these fights that we are fighting, but we are never alone. And that there's a lot of folks out there who care about the very same things that we care about. So that is one of the lessons, is that activism, that resistance, the ability to work together with folks that you didn't even think you'd ever work together with. But ultimately, this is a good story. This is a story of hope. Flint is not going to be defined by this crisis. Flint is being defined by our recovery. story. We are doing things in Flint that aren't being done anywhere in this country. Flint is a story where science was, common sense science was denied, engine parts corroding. But Flint is a story where science ultimately spoke truth to power. And Flint is a story where we are using the science of child development, toxic stress, resilience to buffer the impact of this crisis. And what we are going to do in Flint, what we are learning, we hope to share with children all over this country who are suffering from the very similar toxicities of poverty and discrimination and loss of democracy and lost opportunity. So what are we doing in Flint? We are massively investing in early childhood. That is the period of greatest brain plasticity. We have doubled the capacity of home visiting programs. We have two brand new child care centers, massive expansion of early literacy. So I'm going to throw out some statistics here. So kids in Flint, like in many urban communities, there's about one book for every 300 children. Imagine that. One book for every 300 children. By the time our children reach the age of three, they have heard 30 million less words. By the time of age of 18 months, you already see evidence of that achievement gap, which you cannot fix by kindergarten. So we have made massive investments in early literacy. Right now in Flint, every single kid gets a book mailed to them every single month from the age of 0 to 5. Isn't that awesome? It's so cool. We started a program called Born to Read at birth, at the hospital. We are giving babies bundles of books and signing them up for these programs and developmental toys. There's an evidence-based program called Reach Out and Read, which has been around for decades. We used to have only one clinic did that. Now we have over 10 clinics that are doing this. So massive investments in early literacy as well as two-generation literacy. Kids don't grow up in isolation. They grow up in families. So we're addressing family literacy. We have Medicaid expansion, so healthcare and behavioral healthcare for Flint families. We have mobile grocery stores because Flint is a place that has no nutrition. We have near universal preschool. So all of these things, and there's so much more, all of these things are what science tells us is good for kids. They're also really common sense things, and these are things that all children need everywhere. So that is what we hope to share. And so part of this book is also sharing those lessons, how we can come together and do what kids need, especially our most vulnerable kids. So part of the proceeds of this book, another reason I wrote this book, part of the proceeds go to our Flint Kids Fund. So right after the crisis hit, we were flooded with water bottles, which is awesome. Thank you. I mean, like whenever this nation has a disaster, the warmth and the humanity of this nation comes out. But then we realized, we're not going to need water soon, but we're going to have to be addressing the needs of these children for a long time. So this fund was created as a tomorrow fund for the kids. So this is funding, for example, our breastfeeding work and our nutrition education programs and the literacy programs to make sure that these kids have what they need for the next 20 years or so.
So, we're
so
not
great things are happening. Awesome things are happening.
So we're not going to we're not going to die. In other words, we will have a fact-based democracy.
Yeah, I hope so.
Driven by compassion.
I hope so.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Good.
So the number one.
There's hope.
Yeah. So
you're going to be okay.
Love each other. That's the most important thing. Take care of each other. Take care of our neighbors, and especially our children.
Thank you for that. Okay. We must have questions out there. Do we have a mic going around? All right.
Well, there's so many parts of this story. Thank you so much for this. Would you remind us of when the crisis started, why they switched the water? We need to get that one detail out there because why did they switch
How did this
that?
Happen?
That was a failure of the journalist in the room.
Why did we switch from that wonderful Lake Huron water?
Yeah. So in 2011, Flint lost democracy. So the Flint was almost bankrupt. And in Michigan, if you have dire financial states, the state can just swoop in and usurp democracy. And that's what the state did. We had a financial emergency manager in charge. And that person's job was one thing. It was austerity. It was to save money no matter what the cost. It was big government equals bad government. It was run government like a business. So they decided that the water we had been getting for half a century from the Great Lakes, pre-treated, high-quality, fresh water, was too expensive for this poor, predominantly minority city. And that instead, we would start drawing water from the local Flint River until a new pipeline to the Great Lakes was to be built. So the move to the Flint River was supposed to be temporary. It wasn't the fault of the Flint River. Even though the Flint River has a legacy of pollution, it actually caught on fire twice. It wasn't the river's fault. And it would have been hard to manage anyways because it's harder than a lake water source. But the problem was, and the criminality was, that the water wasn't treated properly. It wasn't treated with this necessary ingredient called corrosion control. And then we later found out, in the greatest irony, that to have treated the water properly would only have cost $80 to $100 a day. That's it. That's it. $80 to $100 a day. But that wasn't done. And the pump to install that treatment was never even installed. There's a microphone guy.
Yeah.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'm so glad that you included your immigrant story in the book. As a Central American scientist also, it's just very important.
So, and a woman.
You. And a woman.
Awesome.
Triple coupon.
I was wondering if you're taking this show to similar communities like in Watts here in LA or Compton, or, you know, what we call environmental justice communities, frontline, fence line communities that need to hear this story firsthand. What are your thoughts about that, or curriculum or stuff, anything that can share your book, your amazing book with?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely why I wrote this book, was to have that larger platform about many of these issues, about environmental injustices. That's not a new concept. People all over this country who are predominantly poor and of color disproportionately suffer from environmental burdens in Flint and Detroit and LA, everywhere. That people need to know about that again and again and again. And there are many, many examples about that. I wrote this book to highlight that lead is still an issue. So, you know, before Flint, people, they thought we took care of lead. We got lead out of paint. We got lead out of gasoline. There's a gorgeous curve where children's lead levels have been going down every year. But and the funding got cut for lead poisoning prevention programs nationally. But the problem hasn't gone away. And at the same time, science has taught us there's no safe level. And at the same time, we know about the disparities. So lead is not a problem of yesterday. It's a problem of today. And it's a problem of tomorrow. And we need to triple and quadruple our elimination efforts so no kid is ever exposed. So the hope of this book and being here and being in other places is to share that story and to create change. And one of the amazing side effects of the Flint water crisis have been the positive ripple effects. So communities now are testing, and they're finding lead in their water, in their schools. I spend so much of my time talking to other communities about their issues with water or children's health or what have you. It's created investments in remediation. Laws have been passed to replace pipes in different cities and communities. So there is a greater awareness, but there's so much more work that needs to be done and so much more funding that needs to go into public health and the infrastructure work. It's just the beginning.
Thank you very much for coming. I followed this problem, you know, in the newspapers as best I could. We didn't get the coverage that Michigan got, naturally. But what I would like to know is why the governor apparently got off scot-free. Apparently two people were sent to prison.
Actually,
no?
Mm-mm. So there's been a lot of, so the question was about accountability and why the governor's still maybe in office. So there have been about 18 criminal charges. Actually, just today, there was more hearings against the head of our state health department. who's been charged with negligent homicide because of the Legionella deaths. A lot of folks were charged with cover-up, with hiding data. So that blood information that I was going after, they already had. They had already seen elevations, and they covered it up. There was a lot of cover-up and negligence and misleading happening in our water quality office as well. So there are ongoing efforts at accountability. This story is not history. Like I said, today there were charges. Like, I was getting texts today from the media. What do you think about what this person just said on testimony? Like, it's happening right now. And that accountability is so important. I think of Flint's recovery as almost like a truth and reconciliation process. We need that truth. We need to know what happened and who knew what and why they did this. And then there's a role for restorative justice and reparations. And then we can really continue on that long path of healing and reconciliation. So it is a bit unprecedented, the accountability that is happening. I compare a lot of this crisis to what happened in Washington, D.C. at about a decade ago, a similar lead and water crisis that actually lasted longer with even worse levels, and nobody was held accountable in that crisis to this day.
And there's some demographics in common with Flint and Washington, D.C.
Both had usurped or no democracy,
and
no
predominantly black.
Absolutely.
Cities, with no representation.
Yep.
Has a very serious Central Valley water problem. The people who grow our food for the nation can't drink their water, can't afford to buy water. Their children are seriously impacted. Accountability is an interesting issue. I remember Lois Gibbs fighting.
I know.
Didn't have a doctor degree, had a high
She's
school
amazing.
Degree. And water is scarce, rare, and we don't know its worth until the well is dry or poisoned. In the Central Valley, water is poisoned, as are many agricultural areas throughout the country.
So
I'm sorry.
I agree.
I guess if there's a question, I'd like to know how to stop what's been going on forever. And with the birth of the chemical industry, Sibagagi poisoned Cincinnati, and they moved to Toms River, and they built something 70 times larger and poisoned all the water.
It's going to get better with this EPA.
Without a doubt. Sin duda.
So vote. But what be would involved. Be, write letters. You know, be civically engaged. And I know you are, and I'm sure you are. And it is David versus Goliath. And that's what it was very much in Flint. But build teams, build networks, be loud, be stubborn, be disobedient, be resistant, do illegal things. Didn't say that loud. So I mean, but you have to, you know, and make unexpected partners. But it's a challenge, and the political climate right now makes it even more challenging. But the part of this book and part of my work and part of my message is: do not give up. Do not give up. You cannot give up for our children's sake.
I actually have two, I hope you don't mind. One is, when did you get to Flint? And the other one is a little more complicated. What kinds of impacts are you seeing in kids, and what kind of long-term impact? I heard from teachers in Flint recently that they're experiencing children with major deficits, preschool age, acting like infants.
So when did I get to Flint? So I actually came to Flint as a medical student. So I went to Michigan State University's College of Human Medicine, which was our very first community-based medical school. So I spent my clinical training in Flint about 20 years ago. That's when I fell in love with the city, the loyalty, the pride, the bravery, the resilience of the city. And that's where I fell in love with the discipline of pediatrics. So I went to Detroit after that. I did my training in Detroit and then came back to Flint to lead the residency program to really train future positions for future pediatricians. Those of you in education, the impact is so multiplicative. It's great for me to go out and practice and be a doctor and be an advocate, but when you are training the next generation of folks to do that, it goes on for generations to come. So I came back to be in charge of that training program in 2011. So you're second question was, how are Flint kids doing? And I think that's the most common question I get asked, like, how are kids doing? And I was in clinic last week, so I took a break from book tour. I went back to work last week, and I was in clinic. And I can tell you how the kids I saw in clinic were doing, but that's not epidemiology, and that's not population health, and that's anecdotal. But we are giving you that population health data. So we were just funded by the CDC to build a Flint registry modeled after like the World Trade Center registry and other big exposure-based registries to see objectively in a data-driven way, how are people doing? And it's not just for kids, it's for adults. It was for everybody exposed to this crisis. But we're not just doing research. We're not just doing tracking. The point of this registry is to get people connected to the awesomeness that has come into the city, to the health service, the behavioral health services, the early education, the home visiting, the literacy programs, and to follow follow people over time. This registry has already launched pre-enrollment. It officially launches this fall. So in maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, I can very objectively answer that question and tell you how people are doing. However, I will never be able to give you the why. And that's the problem with environmental health. You can never prove causation. I saw a kid last week in clinic with attention deficit disorder. The mom wants to know, was it from the lead? I don't know. Maybe he was always supposed to have that. There's so many other toxicities that our children are exposed to that predispose them to this. And just that not knowing increases the anxiety and the frustration and the stress in families. So we won't be able to prove causation, but we'll be able to draw some correlations.
Hi, Mona.
Hi.
Thank you for coming to LA and sharing your story with us. Question for you, I guess, stealing from Michelle Wolf's Correspondence Dinner closing line is, does Flint have clean water yet? Or
yes.
When will they?
Yeah, that was great. She brought Flint back to the national attention. So the people of Flint, so I'm drinking your LA water right now. We cannot do this yet in Flint. We cannot drink our tap water in Flint yet. Our water quality has improved dramatically. However, we are replacing our damaged pipes. And because of that infrastructure work, people need to remain on filters and bottled water. So we had 18 months of this corrosive water that ate up our pipes. The people at the EPA said it was like drinking through a lead-painted straw. You never knew when a piece of that corroded lead scale was going to come off and go into the drinking water. Mark Edwards called it like Russian roulette. You just never knew, like, when you were just going to get like an acute dose of a lead chip, a particulate. So because those pipes are so damaged, they are being replaced. That takes time. And once Flint has replaced their lead pipes, which is going to be done by 2020 by lawsuit mandate, we'll only be the third city in the country that has replaced their lead pipes. There's only two other cities, Lansing, Michigan, and Madison, Wisconsin, that have replaced their lead pipes. So we're once again leading the way here. More cities need to do that. It's mainly lead pipes are mainly Northeast and Midwest problem. We were stubbornly slow as a nation to restrict lead in our plumbing. Not until 1986 did we restrict lead from our service lines, but not until 2014 did we restrict lead from our brass fixtures. And that is all over this nation. Portland, Oregon has lead and water issues, not because they have lead pipes, but because their corrosive water is eating up the lead in their fixtures and releasing it. So that is an everywhere problem. So because we were doing this infrastructure work is the reason that people need to remain on bottled water and filters. And that's frustrating to have to still be on bottled water and filters. And the state just cut bottled water supply. We do have filters in place for the next 2 years, but people are on their own if they want bottled water. Yes, sir.
Hi, thank you so much. So you mentioned this need for building unexpected partnerships, and I'm hearing also a little bit about building coalitions, maybe across scales and the national attention that Flint got, but maybe too late. And I'm thinking about crises, environmental crises, and issues of lead. For example, even here in Los Angeles with the Exide crisis, mm-hmm. How certain crises don't get that national attention, mm-hmm. And what advice you would have to these communities who maybe don't have the privilege of that platform or coalitions of that scale to still make effective change in their communities.
Yeah, so I think one, if you could find one friend to help you make change, it would be science reporters. and
I knew this would turn to me. You said you were going to do this.
and environmental reporters.
Right, right.
So how can folks in the community work with media and journalists to elevate their stories?
Look, that's always a difficult question. You mentioned in the book that you were always wondering what the attention span of journalists is, and I think you overestimated it. Yeah, it may be less than that. I often say that talking to an editor is like talking to a four-year-old with ADHD who needs to go to the bathroom. And that's a polite way to put it. But really, look, we I know that the LA Times wrote the heck out of the Exide situation. So that did catch on. But no, it didn't really quite go farther than that. But I think one of the, if there are two things that can be done, one is know your topic and get the data. That's the lesson of this book. The more that you can collect, the more work you can do yourself, the better off you are. The other one is that it's no longer a case where I'm the only recourse. The media is much more democratic now. You have social media. You have so many other ways to publicize your stories. And while I should make a strong pitch for you all to bring your best stories to a local and unionized workforce at the Los Angeles Times, I would be remiss in not acknowledging the fact that you have a great deal of power to spread your own story by yourself as well. And that, in many ways, will get us to respond. I think sometimes when the story starts echoing back from other places, you start realizing it's a bigger story. We're humans, and we, you know, our attention tends to drift. But that would be my recommendation. And call me, obviously, just call me personally. Yeah. Yes.
I'd just like to suggest that people who want to support science and health journalists buy subscriptions to the newspapers they work for.
Yeah. So if I could, that's awesome. So if I could point to the role of journalists in the story. So there's been many reports about the Flint water crisis and what went wrong, but what also went right. And it's often pointed out how awesome our investigative journalists were. So I talk about him in a book, but there's a journalist, a seasoned journalist named Kurt Guyette, who was actually laid off by where he was working, because print journalists, it's hard to get a job. And he was hired by the Michigan ACLU via funding from the Ford Foundation, who was worried about the emergency manager issue. They wanted somebody on staff to write about what are the consequences when democracy is taken away. So he dug and he dug and he dug and he dug, and he was there and he asked questions and he dug and he dug and he dug. And ultimately it was his reporting that broke a lot of the story. So journalists, local and national, played an incredible role. Rachel Maddow was the very first person. Give her a kudos. So she was on this story not when it was a water story. She was on the story when it was an emergency management story. She recognized the racism and the undemocratic processes of taking away the rights of people and accountability. So the journalists played an incredible role. And I said that it was ultimately science that spoke truth to power. So I had my press conference. I shared my science. They said it was wrong. We fought back with more science. But during that process is when the media exploded. And I think it was really the shame from the media and the media attention that ultimately made the state concede.
So obviously that we're going to be dealing with this in Flint, Michigan for a very long time. Is there anything that we can do here that might help?
Absolutely. So like I said, I wrote this book to bring attention back to Flint. I wanted a spotlight to come back on Flint because this is a long-term issue, and to remind people that this is an issue everywhere. So part of the proceeds of this book go to our Flint Kids Fund. If anybody wants to donate to that fund, flintkids.org, that's an easy way to contribute to Flint. But part of this, one of the lessons of the story is that to help Flint, you don't have to come to Flint. You don't have to give to Flint. You just need to be awake and alert and active in your own communities. There are injustices everywhere, all over, and just get involved in those. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you. Mahogar. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.